Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Before we meet Steve McManaman, I'd like to help you find that Christmas gift you're struggling to get for the football fan in your life. My book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World, is newly updated with 40 extra pages of content on Pep Guardiola's reign at the club, the transition to Tito Villanova as head coach, the tragic death of that great man, Pep's former assistant, from cancer. There's also a new section on the brief but interesting reign of Tata Martino and a reflection on the untimely passing of my idol, Johan Cruyff, the godfather of the modern Barcelona era. The book's available everywhere, but we'd urge you to buy directly from us. Two reasons. Firstly, it'll guarantee you receive the new edition. Order elsewhere, and it's possible you get the original. Secondly, Backpage make a little bit more money if you buy from us, which helps us keep on writing, publishing, and producing these podcasts. Go to grahamhunter.tv/books to buy the book from us. Now, to business. The 4 years that Steve McManaman spent at Real Madrid can be summed up in two Champions League wins, two league titles, and one remark from Johan Cruyff, who described the Merseyside Madridista as el socio de todos, a partner to everybody on the pitch, i.e. the guy that, if you give the ball, you'll get it back in a better position than you did before. Somebody who links play. It's a good description of Steve, I think. Maka would have needed the help of an interpreter to translate such an endorsement during his early days in Spain. But you're about to hear how he overcame the language barrier by throwing himself into the social side of life at Real Madrid. In part one, Steve talks about his ambition to leave Liverpool and play abroad, the unexpected challenges of joining one of the biggest club teams in the world, and the second home he discovered in a dressing room which was supposed to be in turmoil. Disfrútalo. Enjoy. Steve, as I say to every one of my guests, because they're hand-chosen, because they're people I admire, they're not just people of achievement, I think it's a privilege to have you here because you brought me, as a lover of football, I'm a journalist, a lot of fun. You showed adventure, you came abroad, you dominated your life by choosing new things that you fancied and you won at the game. I think that's a brilliant thing in life to do. But the guy who's featured most regularly across all these podcasts when I interview people has been Cruyff because of my admiration for him, and I think he's the most important man in the history of organised football. And a phrase that he used about you is a phrase that I spent the summer with Federico Ardiles, Ozzy Ardiles' son, and Fede said that everybody always used to call Ozzy Ardiles el socio de todos, the guy who could link with, look after, be a friend to everybody on the pitch. And that's what Cruyff said about you, el socio de todos.
Yeah.
Cruyff, a genius and a man who influenced football more than anybody else, looked at you and said, there's not just a gifted player, certainly not just a winger, there's somebody who makes the team function. How much do you associate yourself with Johan Cruyff's description of you?
I think at Madrid, I presume he said it about me when I was at Madrid, and I think that was, you know, it was probably a lot truer at Madrid. I don't think I wasn't that type of player at Liverpool. I was more of a maverick at Liverpool, and I needed to be a leader at Liverpool on the pitch, really, where you come, then you come to Madrid. And of course, you know, I've come to a different country, people speaking different languages. And we had our own leaders at Madrid. Where I was, you know, at Liverpool, I needed to step up and be the leader to a certain extent at Liverpool. In Madrid, we had the Hierros, we had the Raúls, and I was very much under the radar then. You probably became much more of a team player. And to be very honest, it was quite easy because we had some wonderful players at Madrid. And it was quite easy just to fit in. You know, you get the ball, you pass it to your mate. You know, we were so much better than a lot of the teams around. It football became a lot easier. Where at Liverpool, I always felt that, certainly right at the end of my career at Liverpool, the onus was on me to make things happen. Where at Madrid, We had seven people who could make things happen, so it was quite easy to get the ball and pass it to someone who's in a better position than you, and they could pass it to someone who's in a better position than them. You know, invariably somebody created that little bit of magic because we had so many people who could do that, and we'd win games and we'd win trophies, and it was a very happy place to be.
But you came to that conclusion yourself analytically.
Yeah.
Could see, and so already we're talking about football intelligence that goes beyond what you could automatically do as a football player.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if you're the one who's in the best position, you go and do it. We had a huge amount of trust, a huge amount of faith in your teammates. We were all very close, and we knew that we had so many good players. You know, that if someone was in a better position than you, or, you know, you give it to them and they do the magic. You know, if it was Luis Figo, it was his turn to do the magic. And if it wasn't him, it was Zizou who would do the magic. And then if it wasn't him, it would be Raul or Ronaldo as my career went on at Real Madrid. So, you had to trust your teammates. They were your family, weren't they? And if someone was in a better position than you, you can't be selfish, you know.
I completely trust what you're saying. But I think it rings true for not the majority of footballers. I think there's a strain of self-interest in football, and I think what you're talking about is actually something that's either rare or needs to be coached into the majority of players in saying, no, I'll take this, I'll do this myself, it's probably not good for me to benefit that guy next to me, unless you're taught that way or brought up that way, or unless you've got football intelligence. Yeah. I'm just arguing that what you've said there, well, it makes sense, and you're looking back, there's proof. I don't think it's all that normal, say what you've just said.
I think it's horses for courses, really. I think if you're talking about, for instance, we're sitting in Barcelona now. I think if you're talking about this Barcelona team, I don't think there's a huge amount of ego. I think they're quite, you know, like a family. When you see Leo and Neymar and Luis Suarez, you know, come onto the field to play, you don't think there's a whole lot of self-interest there. I consider that to be very family-orientated. You've got one of the greatest players in the world, Iniesta, in midfield, who looks as if he's nice and quiet, looks as if he's quite humble. I don't know him that well, so I can't really say. But he doesn't strike me as in it's all about self-interest for him. He seems as if, like, he's quite happy to let Messi have all the...
You're a very tolerant man. You've tolerated me for all the time we know each other.
I don't know.
With the risk of being boring, I'm still going to say you've just backed your argument about what you did naturally by quoting one of the best teams there's ever been and several of the best players there's ever been. I still argue that what you did naturally, and I'm not trying to bum you up, I want to understand it a little bit more, at least it's worth chewing over. Your average footballer of talent doesn't think that way. Yeah. And if you're backing up your decision-making with Iniesta and Xavi and Messi and Neymar, they're elite.
Yeah.
Why did you think that way?
But I think that helps. I think that the higher up the chain you go and the better footballers you play with, I think they get it.
Yeah, that's a fair
They
point.
Get it.
Yeah.
I think they do.
Okay.
I don't think it's about me. Certain players may exude that. You know, people might think Cristiano's a bit like that, the way it's all about him. But I think the bigger picture, he gets the fact that he's only the player he is if he wins games, if he wins trophies. That's when he becomes the player that everybody talks about. And if he loses, people will criticise him, but then he wins, and he wins the Champions League, and then he wins with Portugal, and you can't doubt him. People said to me, I always remember people back then were saying to me, you know, what's it like to play with Zidane? Because at the time, we know that Florentino handpicked Luis and, you know, Zizou, and we got the best. But they came into the dressing room. I mean, Zizou didn't speak the language at the time. I mean, you know him, he's quite reserved and quite humble and quite quiet. And he came into the dressing room, the greatest player in the world, and, you know, sat down and didn't say a word and just did his magic on the pitch. So it was easy to integrate, as I said. The bosses in our team were Raul, principally at the start, were Manolo Sanchez, then Fernando Hierro, then Raul.
That's two to start with.
Yeah, I mean, Spanish, Madrid down, you know, right through the core, and it was all about the team, and we couldn't have any egos, and we were more than happy. You know, we didn't want any egos. We were here to win. We were here to play. And we were here to do our best. So, you know, I came into the dressing room more than happy. I think there was a transitional stage when I turned in, and Pedro Mijatovic had just left, and Davos Šuker had just left, and there was a lot of rumours. Clarence Seedorf was just going when I was there. You know, people were saying to me, oh, that dressing room's this, and that dressing room's, you know, they're all fighting with each other. And I turned up, and it was a really nice place to be, actually. And I fitted in no problem at all. Even though I didn't learn the language, I couldn't be abrasive and loud because I didn't know the language, but I fitted in and got on well with everybody straight away, and I just thought, you know, this is home, really.
Shoot me down immediately, which you're quite capable and you're welcome to do, but I wonder when you're growing up, if some of the things you learned and then applied at Real Madrid, which helped you, I think, make the team better on a consistent basis, and also made you a footballer who stood out and won trophies. Did you learn some of that? You were an Everton supporter.
I was an Everton supporter, yes.
The Everton team you grew up watching, which I guess must shape your concept of what football's about.
Yeah.
It matches all the descriptions you've used about what you want to do at Madrid. Very tight-knit, very hard-working, working for each other. Devastating unit, despite you could pick out several players in it who were extraordinarily talented.
Yep.
Were you conscious of that influencing you, or when you look back, did it influence you, or is that rubbish? It had nothing to do with it, because your hard drive had that in your head anyway.
I mean, I turned out to be the person I was and the player I was, solely down to my family, really, you know, I presume. I wasn't an idiot, and they would never have let me be an idiot, or they would never let me be arrogant, or they would never let me be self-centred. You know, my father wouldn't have allowed that. Watching Everton was great, and I think joining Liverpool at 16 helped me as well, because 16, I was what? That was 88. Liverpool were in their pomp then. They were great. They were a great team. You know, I had John Barnes. You know, people know I clean John Barnes' boots back in the day where, you know, you're cleaning boots and doing this. And to learn from these characters, Barnes, Whelan, Nicol, Hansen, I had the greatest teachers in the world. And they weren't arrogant. They just wanted to win. And whether it was Kenny Dalglish and Roy Evans and Ronnie Moran, you know, they'd win and it'd be right, forget about that. Let's go and win again. And they just taught you, you know, the most incredible values. Forget about winning. We just won the league. Boom, that's gone now. We need to win again. And you were just driving forward. So to train, to play, to mix with these players as a 14, 15, 16-year-old apprentice for 2 years before literally training with them every day and joining them, they taught you everything that should be correct about football. You know, nowadays we get a bit lost in the money and, you know, the 16-year-olds are getting looked after. You know, they're getting everything before they've actually achieved anything on the pitch nowadays. You don't even have to sort of play to be wealthy, or you don't even have to play football to actually achieve something. So, you know, the values that you were taught back in the day are great. And I think that's why you don't want to harp back onto it, but football now needs to sort of go backwards and start to reinvent itself again.
It's not harping on it at all. I'm really pleased you've taken me to an area that's come up again and again in the podcast and that I wanted to ask you about, because I was very influenced by going to a seminar last year where I was interviewing Cruyff, and Tuchel spoke. The Dortmund coach stood up.
He's like,
very,
I like
young.
Him. I like him.
Sensational ideas and man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Brand of football that you watch. I could imagine you could have played in his team and he loved having you. He stood up and spoke and said, "My name is made," in front of maybe 70 elite football clubs from around the world, gathered simply to share. Mm. It wasn't just a discourse. It was like, it was proper sharing of football knowledge, which again I like, because I think football's a jealous game and secrets are kept when they don't need to.
Yeah, yeah.
Tuchel said that I made my name by being a youth coach. See, when I was a youth coach, I was a shop steward. The best for my kids, best buses. See, I look at what we're doing now. See, we're breeding automatons, robots, who don't have solutions. They're very good doing this as long as they're in a straight line.
Yeah, yeah.
Something
comes
in the way, and it's exactly what you said. Their life is too easy, and we probably train them quite well and keep them healthy and lean about and teach them good habits, but they've got no problem-solving ideas. And we go back to Phil Neville and Damien Duff saying that their apprentices, at a similar time to you, their apprenticeships were hell.
Yeah, yeah.
They were bullied. Yeah. Things that they both used the phrase, people would probably be arrested and put in jail for what was done to us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they both said, themes of what you said, that changed me, that hardened me, that taught me, that made me better. Now, we can't go back to that
not at all.
When you look back, you've only said positive things about what you were being taught as a 16-year-old. Mm. Were there also times when you were completely outside your comfort zone in that moment?
No, I actually remember my apprentice years, the YTS years, with great fondness. But as you've just said, when I speak to other people, you know, Steve Harkness is a friend of mine, played for Liverpool. He was at Carlisle. And he had, like you said, was sometimes bullied at times by the players. It wasn't that bad at Liverpool. I don't think the likes of Ronnie Moran, I said before, the values of the players who were there would never allow them. You know, there was a little bit of mickey taken, but it was never that bad. And I always just remember it with great fondness, to be very honest. And even at 16, you know, Phil Thompson was our manager at the time, ex-Liverpool legend, as you know. You know, and he was always barking orders and shouting at you and stuff. And I was from Liverpool, so it just rolled off me. I took all that no problem at all. I quite liked the fact that when you had a bad game, wow, he told you had a bad game. And sometimes it could be brutal and you thought, oh my word, you know. And other people couldn't take it and other people didn't like it and other people may have went home and, you know, be really upset. But I was fine with it. I thought, yeah, you knew where you stood. He shouts at you, you're rubbish, you're terrible, you're appalling. He left you feeling devastated. And the next day, how are you? No problem. You know, you knew it was just like, there, it's gone. As soon as we leave this dressing room, we're finished. And it was tough, but I found it really fine. I was quite liberated by it all, because I knew when I had a bad game and I was shouting at me in my own brain, I knew I'd have to leave the ground. I'd go home with my father, and my father would go in his eyes and knew that I'd had a bad game, and I felt disappointed. So somebody shouting at me, your manager shouting at you that you were awful, I knew in my own mind anyway, you know. So it was never ever a problem for me. So I never found that the bullying thing was not a problem. And at 16 and 17, I was training with the first team all the time. So I was quickly became one of them at a young age. And, you know, they had to look after me because I was this 17-year-old scouts lad who was travelling with them permanently, you know, not getting changed because, you know, there might have only been 11 and two subs. I'd always be 15th man or 16th man. But I was part of the first team squad very, very quickly. A year before I actually made my debut, I was one of their team or one of their squad.
See, that thing you talked about the relentless drive to win, they forget this, that's not important, it's the next thing. My perception is that in football, everybody talks about it, not journalists. I see a lot of managers and players, particularly when I listen to them or watch them, who don't think like that. They look for maybe the next contract, keeping their team up, keeping their job, whatever it might be. And they use good vocabulary. But that dedication to winning, that ruthlessness about, I'll do everything to win, and I'll do it every day, when I'm tired, when I'm sad, when the family are unhappy with me, when I'm playing badly. That ruthlessness to win, 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 I don't think it's as common as fans and journalists think it is.
Probably not. I think football's changed now, and certainly football managing has changed, isn't it? Because they are looking for three games. You know, you lose three games, you're out of a job, unfortunately, now, and that is sad. So maybe their focus is changed to a certain extent. But if you ask Luis Enrique or Pep, it's all about winning, isn't it? It's not about keeping a job. That's second nature. It's about winning. It's about taking your team to the next level, if you possibly can. It's winning the European Cup. It's winning the best trophies around. Not for your personal pride. That helps, of course. But, you know, to take your club to a little bit of history. If Pep wins it with Manchester City, wow, he's going to be the greatest manager ever to have lived, isn't he? Of course. So they have their own personal pressure on themselves all the time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
But you're 16, you're a very good player. You're making it into the Liverpool setup. You win a couple of games, you win a youth cup. I think it's more natural to go, wow, look where I've arrived to. Look what I'm, you know, you're cock of the walk without ever losing yourself. Yet you were being shown or told. And I don't know if it was more shown or told by Nicol, by Hansen, by Dalglish, by Souness, whoever it might be. That's nothing.
That's nothing.
Absolutely,
it's nothing. My manager at the time was Kenny Dalglish. He was the greatest player ever, wasn't he? If you're a Liverpool fan and I'm playing for Liverpool or Scottish, he was like, it's Kenny Dalglish. When you play for Liverpool and then when you go on to play for Real Madrid, the history is all around you. And it's not about winning a youth cup or winning a reserve league or winning a game on a Saturday for the first team. It's Kenny Dalglish scoring against Bruges. It's, I don't know, Phil Neal scoring penalties in Rome. It's lifted, or Graeme Souness lifting the European Cup. It's Phil Thompson lifting the European Cup, Emlyn Hughes. That's what's on the wall all around you. So you've actually never arrived unless you replicate and you add to the history. You're never as good as what's gone on before you. And it's when I arrived at Real Madrid, it was imprinted. You know what it's like. It was imprinted into you. You've got Alfredo Di Stefano as the club president, or, you know, the honorary president. They've won it five times. You know, I arrived in 1999. and they just had a barren year that year. But the year before, 98, they'd won the... So it's like European Cups, forget that. You've won the league. Who cares about the league? You have to win the European Cup. And it's this, you know, they talk about the undecima now, don't they, and what's going to happen again. And what's... So this strive to... It's never good enough. You win the league and you win the Champions League, fine. Yeah, you have to win the Champions League next year. So when we won it, and then we lost the year after in the semi-finals and won the league, it's like, yeah, but you never won the Champions League again. Champions you haven't retained it. It's like, oh, fuck. So then you have to go and do it again. So it was never, ever enough. You know, we need to repeat it. And, you know, Madrid have just won it. But it's like they instantly talk about, right, we've won it now. We've won it 11 times. Isn't it great? Let's celebrate. But can we be the first team to retain it in the modern era, you know, in this the Champions League format? Can we retain it? So everybody's looking forward again, aren't they, straight away? Straight away. Now, we've won it 11 times, aren't we? Great. Yeah, we are great. But let's see if we can win it at 12. And if we win it at 12 and we retain it, we will be regarded as one of the greatest teams in the world. Can we win it and win the league? Because that is nigh on impossible nowadays. It really is hard to do. Can we win the Champions League and our domestic league? And that's what the good teams and the good players are constantly thinking about.
Just out of curiosity, when you're growing up and you're an Everton fan, these moments you're referring to when Souness, Philtoms, Lifty's cuts, were they, in your neighbourhood, your family, were they dark moments?
They would have been, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
just conceptually.
Yeah, of course they would.
Because at that stage, you're not Steve McManaman, no, European Cup winner, you're a fan.
Steve McManaman, Everton fan, yeah. Yeah, I was at that very famous game where Glenn Keely got sent off for Everton and Rushie scored 4 and Liverpool won 5 at Goodison Park. And I was sitting, you know, bereft as an Everton supporter in the Gladys Street as my junior Evertonian thinking, you know, what's just gone on there? You know that you're going to go to school on the Monday and you're just going to get taunted or whatever. That's just what it was. And thankfully, I went through that age of 84, 85, 86, you know, Peter Reid and Bracewells and Everton won the league and Everton won cups and the European Cup Winners' Cup. Thankfully, you know, I was a teenager going to watch that great Everton team with Sheedy and Trevor Stephen and Sharpie and Andy Gray. And it was like, I was one of the lucky few to really appreciate that as a 12, 13, 14 year old thinking, you know, how lucky am I? I'm watching Everton. 84, when Sharpie and Andy Gray beat Watford in the FA Cup final, I went with my dad. I'm a 12 year old, you know, that was
at Wembley.
Go to Wembley and watch your team win. Things don't get better, do they? As a 12 year old, they don't get better. And then, of course, I was there every bloody year then watching Everton and Liverpool and then actually playing there myself. So I was lucky. But as a 12-year-old, queuing up for your Wembley tickets and having it and getting on a bus with your father and singing songs.
Bus down with your dad. That, I mean, these are...
Greatest time of my life. Singing songs with my dad and, you know, all the men. And, of course, they're having a few beers on the way and talking about football.
It's not illegal.
And effing and blind and stuff. And you just think, this is how amazing is this? I mean, I had all that anyway because I'd watch my dad play football. He played locally in Liverpool. He was good, my dad. He was a good, very good player at amateur level.
Positionally, yeah. What did he do?
I think initially he was very skillful, but everybody always said, you still get it now. You're a good player, but you're never as good as your father. You know, in Liverpool, he had a good reputation, my dad. So I was always, at a very young age, of course, I was a huge football fan, but, you know, from when I could walk, I'd be watching my father play football and I'd be in the pubs with him and sitting there and, you know, on a Saturday waiting for the local, used to be called the Pink Echo in Liverpool. A paper used to come out about 5 o'clock with all the football results and stuff. And I always remember he'd play in the afternoon and we'd go back to the pub and sit there with this Pink Echo looking at all the results and sitting, listening to my father and all his mates talk about these stories. And it was just incredible times.
Was it a rich,
incredible
witty, colourful environment?
Very colourful environment. But again, working class Liverpool, it was just amazing. I just loved being with my father and all his mates and listening to all their stories. And, you know, you felt part of it. Even as an 8-year-old, you felt part of it. You know, you were like being a man sitting there.
I guess it brings you on. It probably gives you aspirations too. I want to be like them. Mm-hmm. I want to do this. I want to achieve. Mm-hmm. And if you see him and he could play, I suppose you begin to model yourself on how you use the ball, what teammates mean to you.
Yeah,
sense
what camaraderie,
of unity.
Of course, yeah, definitely.
Do a little privilege for those who are too young to have seen what you saw. What made Everton special in those days?
Well, what you just said there, I felt that without knowing the players at the time, there was a sense of camaraderie. You know, they played good football as well, which is always great to see. But the likes of Peter Reid and Bracewell in there and, you know, the wingers like Kevin Sheedy and Trevor Steve, and they played the type of, you know, the right type of football. But they always just seemed to be a really good group of players. I always feel like you get that. You know, the successful ones... It's probably a myth and because they're successful, but you always feel as if you look at them and think, you know what, they all get on. You know, they're all mates. I always felt that at Liverpool when I was growing up watching the great teams. I still see a lot of the players now, the ex-Liverpool players, and we have, like, you know, a group where we'll always meet up and have a Christmas, and everybody gets on well. There's no idiots, and you think to yourself, that always helps that. And I look up, as I said, I look up the Barcelona team now without knowing any of them.
No, you've
met a few of them, and I always think, you know what?
You're on the money.
They seem all right. There doesn't seem to be any huge egos. There doesn't seem to be any pain in the arses in the team. They always look as if, you know what? Let's win, and then we'll go and enjoy ourselves afterwards.
And what's more, when one arrives, they sift them out.
Yeah, that's what I feel. That's what I feel. I feel that when people arrive, if they come into the camp and they cause trouble or don't fit, they're out. I had it at Real Madrid with Nicolas Anelka. Nicolas came. You knew within a month there was bits in the paper about Raul Morientes, or when he goes back to France in L'Equipe, there's an interview, I don't like it, Madrid. And you knew within 2 months he's gone at the end of the season. And Nicolas played in the Champions League final, scored goals.
Yes, that Bayern Munich goal.
Scored goals in the semi-final.
Got you there, right?
Absolutely, scored goals. And it was vitally important. He was back in the team, no problem, and he played in the final. But you knew, he's just won the Champions League. You knew that within a month he's gone. You know, whether he just wasn't the right fit at the time, and he moved on to other things. But you knew within a month or two, right, he'll go at the end of the year.
I'm skipping about here. We're skipping about in butterfly fashion, rather than being narratively straight. But you actively wanted to play abroad.
Yes.
Right? It was a desire above and beyond the fact that it fell into your lap. There was such a thing as a Bosman move. Mm. And you could move for free, and that was beneficial contractually. That's nice.
Yeah.
We all work to live. But you had some sort of yearning to, test yourself, learn. Tell me what it was, other than just playing for Real Madrid, that drove you to say, yeah, I want something continental in my life.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't. The Bosman thing was one of those things, but it certainly wasn't financial, because the money Liverpool offered me at the end to stay and join them was virtually on a par. I actually just wanted to leave. I wanted to go and play abroad. At that time, I'd never played in the Champions League, which was a huge thing. And Liverpool, back in the days of, you know, you need to be champions to play in the Champions League, or, you know, I hadn't played in the Champions League. I was playing really good football, and I needed to test myself, I think. You know, my mother had just passed away in the May, right at the end of the season, but I'd already made that decision to go. I don't know what it was at the time. I needed to go. I felt as if I didn't want to play in the Premier League anymore. I didn't want to play for someone against Liverpool. I wanted to go and test myself. I was playing really good football, so I had the right type of clubs that were interested in me, and of course,
Barcelona, Juventus, Real Madrid, to name but three.
Good teams, yeah. And I could have gone to Italy. I was nearly going to go to Italy early on. I was taking Italian lessons that year, thinking about going to play in Italy.
Juve being the prime?
I think so, yeah. I'd spoken to Ian Rush. I think I'd spoken to David Platt. You know, I said, what was it like and things like that. December, January came around, and then Madrid were interested. And I thought, you know what? They just won the Champions League. That famous white kit. The lure of playing Juventus at the time were amazing, of course. Again, the likes of Platini and all that. Those iconic figures that were inbred in your mind. But then, you know, Madrid came along and they just won that club, whatever it was called, the Tokyo Club World Intercontinental Cup at the time. They just won that, and they were the best team in the world. So it was like, well, you know, that's not bad. You know, they were officially crowned the best team in the world, albeit that year I think they finished second in the league, I'm not sure. But it was like, wow, you know, you've got the opportunity to join Real Madrid. You know, that iconic white shirt, Di Stefano era, best team in the world.
What were the barriers? Were there nerves?
Absolutely.
Did you worry about the language?
Absolutely, yeah.
Domestically, did you think about, is it the right place for me to live, aside from the football? What were the thoughts?
The thoughts were, this is going to be really difficult. I'm going to need to learn the language. I started taking Spanish lessons quite early on, but then my mother was very ill at the time, and I stopped the Spanish lessons. I used to have a tutor come round to the house, and I said to him, you know what, leave it. I don't want him round the house with my mother very ill upstairs. And so I was taking little bits of Spanish lessons whenever I could, but that was my only concern. The city I knew was a beautiful city. I lived in Liverpool. Everywhere was going to be bigger. Everywhere was going to be sort of better than Liverpool, because it was only a small town of, what, 500,000 people, 500,000 people. So I knew it was going to be a change. The main thing was the language barrier. That was it. It was like, I'm going to have to learn the language. When I actually got to Madrid, it probably wasn't as organised. It probably wasn't as more of a family club than Liverpool. You know, they were big and they were a huge club, but they were a little bit disorganised. You know, there was no players' lounge, there was no this. I always remember the following year, actually, when Florentino came in and Butragueño, when he brought El Butre with him. I remember Butre saying to me, what did they have in Liverpool? You know, did they have a players' lounge? Did they have a creche? Did they have this? And I said, well, Liverpool have this. And now it's a million miles away from what it was. But, you know, I always remember my wife turning up to watch the game and just standing outside, you know, in the freezing cold, waiting for the players. She used to call it the pig pen. Everybody used to stand there in this corrugated area, freezing cold, waiting for all the players to finish the game, get changed and come out.
It's literally ridiculous, isn't it?
Ridiculous at the time, and I just thought, oh my God.
Your book's very good, and I went back and read it at the time, and they didn't even help you find a place to live, did they?
No, not really. It was a case of, again, back then, you've joined the best team in the world. Get on with it.
Get on with it.
But, you know, as I said, I think I said in the book, I turned up a couple of months before in the summer. I'm never told Real Madrid and started house hunting on my own, so nobody knew. So I turned up on a Friday or whatever and organised, you know, 20 houses to look at without Real Madrid knowing. I'd sorted out my house then. So I picked a house on that fact-finding mission and said, right, paperwork, blah, blah, blah. It'll take 6 weeks so I can move in. And it was like, well, cool. So when I arrived back for pre-season training, I moved into a house. There was no five suitcases in a hotel room for me. I was in the house.
What I'm hearing there is the evidence of what you said you learned under Nickel and Hansen and Uglish, like prepare to win.
Be
ready.
Be ready, yeah. There was no way I was going to be, I'm stuck in a hotel room. I can't swing a cat in this hotel room. I'm bored. I'm ringing room service. I was in my house. I mean, thankfully, my wife, I went to pre-season training for 2 weeks in Austria or whatever. And by the time I'd come back, she'd furnished it. She had the television in. You know, she had this in, she had that. So I came home and, you know, I'm home. Whoa, and I'm in. I'm home.
Makes a difference.
A huge difference. A huge difference. I just drove to and from the training grounds all the time. I lived in a really nice area. So I come and did all that without anybody knowing. And I always remember there were sightings of me in Madrid because I was this new signing. People were like, so the press were going absolutely ballistic because I was in Madrid. The new signing was in Madrid looking at houses. And nobody knew. She was like, where the bloody hell is he? He's been seen at in a restaurant. He's been seen at such a place. And then I went back. I picked a house and went back to the airport. And the press were waiting for me at the airport. And they were like, you know, we can't believe you're here. And nobody knew about it. And I was like, yeah, okay, I'll see you later. And I was back on the plane back to Liverpool. My house was done. So it was just a matter of moving in and getting, you know, getting some furniture in and making it livable.
You've touched on something that I, having lived here, I noticed very much. There are certain players who achieve and are respected for achieving. Certain players who maybe don't achieve and are liked anyway. There's a group of players in the middle, and I think it's a small group who maybe achieve, but are liked irrespective of what they've done on the pitch. Maybe they've got character, maybe they're cheeky, maybe they represent the club's philosophy or idea, but the fans just want them. I've always felt, while you were playing here and subsequently when you went away, something that you did, your comportment, your, like, maybe your bravery on the ball, like, give me the ball, I'll do something with the ball. If the team's not working, I'll make something happen. Also, I think you approach football irrespective of wanting to win all the time. You showed fun. You showed football's
friendly
side.
Absolutely.
Am I right? And that's what, or certainly the fans and the media think this about you. I think you were liked and respected as a character, even above what you were at Madrid.
I think so. I was always a very friendly type of person anyway. So, you know, I was at Madrid, and even though I couldn't speak the language initially, I was always, you know, I'd always smile, I'd always shake people's hands, I'd always say hello to people. I was never cold or frosty with people. I'd always sign autographs, 10 minutes just to sign a few autographs, whatever. I'd get trophies off some of the fans, like, you know, the best person in the dressing room, you know, and things like that. And you think to yourself, even though I didn't understand it, I had a decent relationship with people. I think it was just because they felt, or people probably felt, you know what, he's all right, you know, he's a nice fella, him. Even when I went to Austria,
first pre-season,
I couldn't speak, I could speak conversational Spanish, but of course, I shared a room with Manolo Cannavale, his name was. He couldn't speak a word of English, I couldn't speak a word of Spanish, but I knew he was a nice lad, and he knew I was a nice lad just by, we'd smile, we'd, you know, do rude hand gestures, you know, we'd say stupid things to each other, but he knew that I was okay. And I'd sit with the lads and have a couple of beers, and I'd just sit in silence, but they knew I was all right, because I went out my way. I didn't just go and hide in my bedroom. It was like, right, I need to get involved with the lads. So they'd all, 10 of them would have a beer and speak Spanish, and I'd just sit there and have a beer with them and smile and, you know, say buenos dias or whatever. They knew, without knowing me, because, of course, I couldn't speak the language, they knew that he's okay.
Because anybody listening to this who hasn't lived abroad doesn't know that. If you're sitting in a group of people with whom you'd like to say something witty or keep up with the conversation or contribute, and you can't understand a damn thing, no matter who you are, that can be quite intimidating.
Yes, definitely.
Or you feel a bit foolish, or it'd be akin to what people feel if they're, you know, deaf or blind or dumb. You've got a handicap, temporarily, in your case. So, like, it's a conscious thing that you have to show. You can't hide, you can't go and, like...
Yeah.
fucking hell, I'm tired of this. Yeah. I train my arse off, double session, yeah. I'm fucking knackered. I can't understand anybody. Yeah. I tell you what, I feel
I'm
shit,
just,
I'm going to bed.
I'm going to go to bed and what, just sit there. So I just, I went out my way, and that was, they were the lonely parts. You just felt, I have to sit. If they say, you know, and they'd always invite me, we're going to go to such a place, do you want to come? And I'd go, yep. You know, it was never a case of, oh, no, you know what, I'll take the easy option, I'll sit in my room and read a book. It was like, yeah, we'll go. And you just sit there again, and you laugh, and you smile, and you try and get involved. But as you know, Spanish people speaking Spanish, even if you understand it, they're that quick. They're speaking slang, they're telling jokes. It's like sitting with six Scousers.
It's machine gun fire.
It's just impossible to understand. So you just have to put yourself out there and think, you know what, this is what I have to do. That's what I did. And they knew that I was okay. They knew, you know what, Macca's all right.
The Big Interview is produced by Backpage and me, Graham Hunter. The music you always hear, the music that you love, is Beer Jacket, who's always been there for us. Big hug to you, baby. You can keep up with everything that we do, within reason. You can enter exclusive competitions and put your questions to our future Big Interview guests by getting on the mailing list at grahamhunter.tv. How many times do I have to tell you? Yes, several thousand of you have done it, but come on, slackers at the back, sign up. That grahamhunter.tv site is also where you can buy the new updated version of my book, Barca, The Making of the Greatest Team in the World. It's my account of the Guardiola era at the Camp Nou from 2008 until 2012, plus Tito, Tata, and adios, Johan Cruyff. It is in all good bookshops now, but it does also make a big difference to all of us who've worked on the project if you choose to buy direct, particularly for Christmas, at grahamhunter.tv/books. You'll be sure to get the new edition, and you will be helping us to continue producing independent content. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being there. Without you, this would be fun, but a lot less fun. See you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.